Worldwide Alumni Celebration is the annual celebration of London Business School's incredible network of 44,000 international alumni, connecting our community of diverse minds all around the globe. At the 2019 event in Dubai, Florin Vasvari, Professor of Accounting and Academic Director of the Private Equity Research Center at London Business School, led a panel discussion focused on how the private equity funds can support and generate economic growth in the UAE and the MENA region.
So let me introduce our distinguished panelists this evening. It's my great pleasure to host His Royal Highness Sheikh Maktoum, Hasher Maktoum Al Maktoum. Sheikh Maktoum is presently the chairman of the Dubai International Holding Company, which is a private firm with extensive investments in natural resources, mining, and energy. He is also the president of Al Fajr Investments, real estate developments in JLR or Jumeirah Lake Towers. He's also the chairman of Artemis Resources, which is an Australian gold mining exploration company, and the chairman of risk and a board member of the Commercial Bank of Dubai. Sheikh Maktoum has received numerous accolades and awards. Amongst them, he was named the Young Global Leader by the World Economic Forum, which is a very prestigious organization, as you might know. My next distinguished panelist is Omnia Kelig, who is our alum, graduated recently. Omnia is the chairwoman and managing director of Naeem Financial Investments, which is part of Naeem Holding Group. She's also the chief investment officer and member of the executive committee of Naeem Holding Investments. And this is an investment firm based in Cairo, but also in Dubai, with investments of over $300 million in various real estate, industrial, and financial businesses. Prior to joining Naeem, Omnia was the founder and managing director of Viveris Mashreq, a subsidiary of Viveris Management in France, a private equity company with over $4 billion under management. And last but not least, we have Iyad Malas. Iyad has more than three decades of experience in the financial, retail, and real estate sectors, leisure, entertainment. He's at the moment partner at Gateway Partners, which is a private equity firm based in Dubai and also Singapore, managing over $750 million in assets with investments in Africa, Middle East, and Southeast Asia. Prior to Gateway, Iyad was the CEO of the Majid Al Futtaim Group, which I'm sure you all know, one of the largest family conglomerates in the MENA region. Thank all of you for joining us. The topic of our discussion today is on private equity, and I would like to kickstart our conversation by asking you why UAE has become the center of private equity funds or managers of private equity funds in the MENA region. I mean, UAE has performed relatively well as an economy and maintained its position as a center for private equity for quite a while now. And I wanted to ask you, what do you think are the main factors that contributed to this success of the country in managing to attract private equity fund managers, in particular in Dubai? Sheikh Maktoum?
Well, I would say primary and secondary infrastructure. Primary being the connectivity that the Emirates Airlines bring, which was part of His Highness's vision to connect UAE to the world, and the roads, the highways. I mean, if you think about the traffic today, the roads, since the financial crisis till now, has actually doubled in kilometers. The metro wasn't here when the financial crisis started. We have the metro. So it's absolutely amazing seeing the population, since the financial crisis till today, has doubled. And it's safety, security, infrastructure, and secondary infrastructure, which is entrepreneurs like yourselves, actually built.
If I may add to this as well, it's what Sheikh Maktoum said is all reflected in Dubai's or UAE score in ease of doing business. It's ranked 11th amongst 190 countries by the World Bank. All the other GCC Council members are lined up far away, starting maybe 68th position by Bahrain, then 90-something by Saudi Arabia. Some important, quite leaps. in terms of time taken to open up a company, ease of registration of real estate property, bankruptcy, preventive compensation and restructuring loans, pledge agreements for movable collaterals. All these are very important when it comes to investment, that you know that there are protections and you know how to exit.
I see. Iyad, what is your view? I mean, you've been here so many years.
Obviously, maybe I can just add the fact that you're all here. I mean, obviously, Dubai has become an attractor of talent. And I think that's obviously quite important for a financial services industry. The existence of the DIFC as a regional financial center has obviously played quite an important role in attracting many financial services companies. And I think, you know, even for a company, I mean, Gateway, which is a relatively young company, you know, we had a choice of where we wanted to be. But given the footprint of the region we wanted to invest, Dubai was clearly one of the two centers that we thought would give us the right coverage. Singapore, Asia, and Dubai covering the Middle East and Africa and even India. So that location, connectivity, and people are three key pillars for what makes a financial service industry we have it.
Do you see any other competitor emerging in the region? Any other city that would be able to compete with Dubai?
No.
Very good. Excellent. Thank you. Now, what can the UAE government do to improve further the environment? Do you think there's anything else that could be done?
Look, in brief, I had an investment banker friend of mine who runs private equity, mainly in debt. And he complains over the last 10 years about everything in Dubai. So I spoke to him, I had dinner with him about maybe 2 weeks ago. And I said, so when are you moving to London? He said, I'm not. I said, why? He said, Dubai is the worst. This is the best of the worst choices I have. It's just a nice place to live. So in a nutshell, everyone looks at recommendations to governments through their point of view. So he is very DIFC oriented from a governance standpoint. He is complained a lot about Abraj and the reputational damage to the DIFC and everything else. But at the end of the day, he's saying this is still a good jurisdiction.
Of course.
So to add to that, actually, I think it is not a missing effort by the government of UAE. There is a need for inter-collaboration across countries to facilitate transaction execution. Let me give you an example. The recent acquisition of Uber for Careem has been cleared by the competition authorities in UAE. Yet, Careem runs operations in 18 other countries within the MENA region. None of those countries' competition authorities have cleared them for the deal to go through. The deal is priced at around $3.1 billion. And for each country that fails to give the blessing for the acquisition to go through, a percentage of the $3.1 billion price is going to be cut off the deal. It's capped at 15%, but the deal size will go smaller. This should be all settled, I think, by Q1 2020. Talks are still held between, can you imagine, 18 countries still have to decide on that? It's a pain. A GCC and a MENA collaboration across countries to facilitate the execution.
I see. And do you think the delays are due to simply bureaucracy or
no, I don't think the countries even have some of those departments even.
It's competition authorities, yes, not in all of them. You have them in Saudi, you have them in Egypt, you have in Qatar, I think. Not sure about the rest of the African countries they are operating in.
Whether they're effective.
Yeah,
but of course many of them are arguing that if the deal goes through, the riders or the consumers will be stuck with one road-hailing company or ride-sharing companies, and it's rather a monopolistic behavior.
Yeah, what is your view?
I think on the issue of what can be done, I personally think actually one of the biggest issues in the region is exits, and that's really the development of the local capital markets. If you look at over the last 10, 15 years, there's probably deals been done on a regional basis. People look at Egypt, they look at Turkey, but in reality, in the GCC, there's not been too many actually very successful exits through the capital markets. I think the problem today is, you know, we have too many different, I mean, Dubai has one, Abu Dhabi has one, Saudi Arabia has one, and you need to drive liquidity into markets into
and
one. I mean, if we really think about this being one region, we need to have all the liquidity come into some regional hub. That hasn't happened, and I think that's if there is something governments on a regional basis can do, which would be helpful for the development of any company, because at the end of the day, you know, the capital markets are there either for people to be able to exit their investments or give an opportunity to investors to then enter into companies and have the liquidity to be able to continue to raise capital.
Another thing also that needs to be looked upon, and this is a regional issue, is the enforceability of options as a means of exit. Mm-hmm. Currently, we are seeing inversion in terms of valuations. What do I mean by inversion? That the private equity companies are demanding higher multiples than those traded in the stock exchange. This is an inversion because you should pay a premium for liquidity.
Of course.
So if this persists, and it should not, because this happened only when the barbarians at the gate in 1980s, right? Prior to the 2008 economic crisis, and now. It should not persist for long, but as long as this persists, the capital market ceases to be an exit route. The alternatives are usually that PE firms put into the structure of the deal a put option for exit to put back their shares. Those things are not recognized properly by the laws in the region, by the way. We do some sort of escrow accounts to get over this with the maturity of the market. But here, even if the PE can invoke its put option, it needs to get approval by a UAE court. The same for Egypt, by the way, if there is no escrow account. So with what's happening with the listed or capital markets, enforceability of options contracts as a means of exit is key.
So I would say legal disputes. Most wealth in the UAE today, as there is a generational shift, is actually being held up in inheritance disputes due to lack of family planning. I mean, it's, I would say, billions and tens of billions of dollars trapped. And these disputes, what one generation doesn't realize is when, let's say there's four brothers, they have kids. Let's say the court cases can take up to 10, 12 years. Wow. Let's say half of them pass out. Now suddenly there's the second generation, 20 children that have to fight over certain assets. And a lot of these assets is prime real estate that gets unused, and it's very complicated to divide it up 20. So I would say the laws in terms of derivatives, options is important, but there's a psychological barrier, a negativity due to the lack of understanding of optional structures that stops the government from fully endorsing it, and whether the question, is it Sharia compliant or not? And is it right, is it not right? And it's due to lack of understanding. You know, whenever I see an imam try to preach about banking, I kind of just pull out a £1 note and say, this used to be worth £1 of gold, you know, and interest is applied to maintain that value. So the dispute between religion and finance is very hard to meet. I know lawyers that don't understand half of what's happening in finance, and some people in finance actually understand law a little bit better.
But it's By practice.
So in some cases in restructuring, I actually had to translate between an audit firm, one of the big five, and a lawyer because they could not even understand what they're saying. So throw in a religious scholar and options, and it's
overcomplicated.
It's not going to be resolved. Yeah. But look, a legal framework that is not based on French law, that is based on Egyptian law, complicates things. But for a country to move from French-based law to English law is not easy.
Yeah.
In Dubai, we have the hardware. We have everything else that goes with it. But we still lack a lot of software. We lack enough qualified people. Even in the banking sector, it's a nightmare trying to hire Arab nationals, never mind Emiratis. And with all this Emiratization drive, it's a challenge hiring someone, training them up. And the next thing you know, another bank comes in and offers him double, triple, and picks him up. So that competition is there. So we're still waiting for the software to come through. And it's just down to legislation, and it's going to take time. I mean, I think there are a lot of people working in banking, but what I would call high-level, executive-level Emirati bankers, I know five. That's it. I'm not going to say their names, but these five are the cream of the crop. Young, driven, smart, educated, experienced. And literally, if I have questions, those are the only five I would ask.
Yeah, so obviously it takes time. It takes many, many years to
decades.
To get the education at that level. And of course, you need experience, right? People need to experience different market environments. I mean, maybe to some extent, things are changing here too fast, as you said. You know, the improvements in the hardware are taking place very fast, and the software updates lag behind. But this year, the UAE government passed a very interesting law allowing 122 economic activities in 13 sectors to be eligible for up to 100% foreign ownership. Is that opening up an opportunity for private equity funds? Not necessarily those that are based in the region, but even those that are based in Europe or the US. What do you think, Omnia?
Yes, I see it quite clear because of scalability and buy-to-build options, because the ability for foreigners to own 100% of businesses has been opened up in Egypt for decades. And for example, you would see last year the GEMS school operator is coming to inject around $300 million of investments in Cairo or Greater Cairo for opening around 30 international schools, and they have the right to 400% ownership or an absolute majority. Now, when screening deals, the PE firms will be looking at scalability of the model. So allowing them to enter the market as well with the same structures of 100% ownerships, meaning they can, for example, want to have access to the sheer population of 100 million in Egypt, yet have access also to the economic flavor of the UAE and being the biggest in the region in terms of M&A, means they can cut and paste the model here and there as well. So it puts them in a different place as well in the top of the screening process.
If I might add, I mean, obviously, I think that's going to be an important factor, because the reality of the matter, there are many sectors that have been closed to or partly open to foreign investment needing a local partner, which means, you know, maybe for someone who's from the region, he's willing to go through either a local arrangement or nominee shares. But many of the global funds are not willing to take the risk of saying, well, you know, I'm not going to have a structure that has a nominee. At the end of the day, it has to be completely transparent, bulletproof, and what have you. So I think this is going to be an important factor in terms of attracting foreign investment. Unfortunately, I think this has coincided with a downturn in economic cycle regionally. So we haven't really seen the benefit of global funds looking, but I think that's going to be one important factor.
I would approach it actually quite differently. If you look at all of Africa, which has been colonized, pretty much you can own 100% of your business. But what you've had is one of the highest levels of poverty, where the local population has benefited zero. Mm-hmm. I've seen billion-dollar gas deals in Africa, no country named, and the local population has really been just chewed out, and they get none of it. It's processed offshore, sold offshore. The receivables don't even land in the country, so there's, you know, everyone's very hot about social responsibility and cocoa farms, but the reality is the model I would use is say, okay, you need to have a percentage partner, but a paid-up partner. Mm-hmm. So basically, as the profits roll, okay. Mm-hmm. It pays up for the shares. It's the same as the oil structure deals that happen for countries that are poor, is that they earn their shares beforehand. However, you have a lot of oil companies that they use the what they call the golden drill rig model, where they apply all the costs of all the oil rigs on certain projects to allow them to gain profitability over a certain period of time. So look, governments are not perfect. We're lucky to have a government that operates so fast and so efficient here. I mean, the government is almost fully digital, and in some of the institutions I work for, we're still dealing with paper. So the government Dubai is pushing absolutely the envelope in modernization, futurization. And all I'm saying is, you know, I met a couple of Emiratis who are in their 60s and 70s, and their only source of income is the five companies that they sponsor earning, you know, around $200,000 a year. If those companies didn't exist and didn't need those people anymore, it's a token price for some of these companies, you know, the government will not find that guy necessarily. Will not be able to benefit him. So I believe every indigenous person going from South America to every other country, that there is a portion where you can uplift mm-hmm. the person. It would make a difference. And it's better than the money sometimes going to government.
Of course. It's a better allocation.
No, so I think obviously, in other countries, there is taxation.
Yeah.
So you tax that, then you then provide services to indigenous people, et cetera. I mean, obviously, here, this is a.
But governments are not usually that efficient.
Yes.
You know, it's good for someone to feel like they're working. They get up in the morning. They sign licenses. I mean, okay, then getting personal handouts. I can't remember where. Somewhere in Fiji, Vinitu, the government just hands over cash to the people. They were actually selling the excrement of bats. And it became one of the richest countries in the world per capita, higher than Brunei. Selling excrement of bats just off Papua New Guinea. They're bankrupt today. They have no money because they were just handing out cash. People had big lifestyle and you know, okay, bat excrement finishes. Oil will finish. But at the end of the day, the money, the culture, the transfer of technology and knowledge lasts. So balancing this with indigenous people, you're talking the Aborigines of Australia, the Africans of Africa, the South American indigenous population, you still have that actual strife.
Yes.
That's there. And most of North and South America have actually been colonized. Australia has been colonized. Africa has been colonized. It's been uncolonized, independence, war, the normal cycle. So there, as long as you have social justice, mm-hmm. where people feel happy and they're contributing, I think that is actually profitable, because the more instability you have, the more losses you have. We went from Arab Spring to Arab Nightmare. People don't understand that the French Revolution took 200 years of lynching people on the streets before they ended up with stability. That's not good for business. Stability is good for business. And one part of stability is, if you imagine a pyramid and the distribution of wealth, if it's very narrow, and a lot of people there, they become like the Romans, and they start thinking about revolution. If it's too flat and too little rich people and everyone else is poor, you have a revolution, which is the French Revolution.
So basically, the fact that the UAE government has relaxed the foreign ownership rules, would you interpret that as being a sign that there's no need for that anymore, or?
Look, I would love to make it 100% all foreign assets owned foreign, but I don't think that every indigenous person would do the right thing. Mm-hmm. It's short-term thinking for big profits that will trump the long-term benefits. So when the government here in the past 20 years would give a piece of land to a local, they don't build him a house and give him this and that. They'd give him a free plot of land to build. Part of the regulation is you cannot sell that land. Because you know what happens. He sells the land, goes ask for another land.
Yeah.
And he does it again and again and again and again until the government put on the restrictions. So there is abuse in the government system sometimes from individuals, and short-term gain trumps long-term stability and benefit. So it's a hard balance to actually
but
do.
But this law is passed already, right? As far as I know.
The law is passed. Yes. You can't sell gifted land.
Yes.
And if you do sell it, if it's a commercial land, you have to pay, I think, 30% fee
of
the value of the land, and then people start thinking twice about it.
No, my question was about the 100% ownership.
I think it would be a lot of fun for some of the monopolies here. I would just like to see franchise holders who have been holding on franchises and being inefficient. I mean, I like to go boating. I use certain engines from a certain manufacturer, and I'm not going to say the name, but literally the dealership or the distributor is useless. He's just benefiting from having a monopoly on supplying
that particular
engine, which is completely useless because it's a great engine, but you don't have spare parts, you don't have maintenance, and it stifles business at the same time. So for fun, sometimes I'm like, I hope you get 100% foreign ownership. I'll start right next to you.
So I've been teaching private equity for many years and interacting with a lot of private equity firms in Europe, US, and also here. And one thing that strikes me is that for many years, a lot of private equity firms from Europe and North America came to the Middle East to raise money. Not to invest here, but just to raise money. Obviously, there's a lot of liquidity here. And I often ask, you know, Middle East is like a developed market, young population growing very fast. Why don't we invest in the Middle East? And other than the issues of exit and all that, the number one concern that I hear is that we just can't compete with the family businesses in the Middle East. They own the best businesses, they control the best businesses, and it's just very difficult to buy them because nobody's selling, and very difficult to compete with them. So to some extent, the very successful families in the Middle East have been running private equity firms themselves. What I wanted to ask you, how do you think private equity firms that are professionally managed can penetrate a market like this that is dominated by family companies? Yeah, you've been running one of those companies.
I was on both sides of the fence, if you like, having run 6 years Marshall Fontaine Group. There is two things that over time will happen. I mean, as the next generation comes into the business, some people want to be in business, some people don't want to be in business. We go through economic cycles, so companies also begin to say, I need to focus on core business, I need to divest from businesses. I think this is where I believe the second generation changes are beginning to happen in our region, and therefore you're going to begin to see first new startups, but also family businesses that either begin to say, well, I'll list some, or I'll sell some businesses, and that's where private equity can play a role more and more. I think you're beginning to see that, but there is actually a lot of also entrepreneurship. I mean, VC is a relatively new phenomenon in the region. There is now a number of funds. There have been a couple of successful VC-started companies, Karim being clearly one of them, Souq being the other. I think all this is going to create more momentum. And you know, this either Karim nor Souq were started by family businesses. People have seen the opportunity.
But those are unicorns. I mean, that's not typical.
Not the regular model, yes.
But there are many others. I mean, I gave the two biggest examples because these actually have now become global companies. And that's actually quite encouraging because, you know, people don't talk about Network International. It was also a spin-off from Emirates NBD. It's listed in London. NMC is listed in London. But that goes back to my point.
I IPO'd NMC.
Too big. Sorry?
I IPO'd NMC.
Hero. But unfortunately, they had to list in London.
Again, I know, we did the listing there.
The markets here were not supported.
No, we recommended, actually, London. We got them a 10-time multiple over
but
what
why,
the shareholder...
given that we have so much capital...
No, the market was dead here. It was just after the financial crisis. In the market, there was no liquidity. Look, from I hate doing business here. I like doing business from here. You know, there's this restaurant in Dubai Mall. A young woman, I heard, who was a government employee, went to Indonesia or Malaysia, found a restaurant chain and brought it here, became highly successful. It's called Papa Roti. Mm-hmm. Within under 30 days, there was Mama Roti. I'm not joking, literally. Then there was all other derivatives of roti. And in Dubai, you have 10 families. You have, I think, 5 in retail, then you have in master retail, then you have some in sub-retail. And if you come up with one idea, if money can buy that idea, they would copy it in 30 seconds. If you drive on Beach Road, you'll find burger, 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 dentist. Burger, 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 shawarma. Burger, 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 cosmetic surgery. And it repeats for 20 kilometers. It just repeats. And I cannot, I mean, sometimes if I go to a restaurant, it's not very often, I try not to avoid restaurants as much as possible, how many cosmetic surgeons there are, how many shawarmas there are. So they eat the burger and then go do cosmetic surgery afterwards. So here, all the merchants, if they, first of all, when they, you know, the first time I asked my father, I said, give me $1 million, I want to start my business. He tapped me on my shoulder, he said, son, now you're a man. And he drove off. And that's when I said, okay. And I started my business from scratch and built it up internationally. Look, if you operate from Dubai, think globally. Think like regionally, at least, because the market here is very small. If you look at, you know, the Arabic dress, abaya, or how many Kandor dresses, the local population is 10%. And literally 10% is trying to sell to 10%. It does not work when 90% of the population is expatriate.
Yes.
You have to tailor to that. I mean, the turnover of one of the restaurants in DIFC is over $100 million. They sell fish.
I know.
It's incredible. So what I'm trying to say is my recommendation, my point of view, nothing succeeds if you're only going to think locally. Nothing actually works. We do not have the population density. We have the wealth, but we have too few people controlling that exit of wealth, which reduces your multiple for an exit. So all my businesses are business models that cannot be replicated with money. That is what I try to do. You need skill, knowledge, capability, expertise, dedication, where not another guy will pop up, throw a bunch of money, and just copy your model. You're going to sink.
Yes, it's a total agree. And adding to this, the main challenge will be in, again, the deal origination, because I see that the global PE funds coming into the region, they are sitting on lots of dry powder. Mm-hmm. And with the sovereign funds and family offices active in the same industry as well, there will be too much money chasing too few good assets. Comes again the idea of regional expansion, scalability of the models. So
an overvaluation, of course.
Exactly, because asset prices will soar. So the private equity who will make it through will have to do origination on a global level and a granular level. They will have to use their relationships to try to place preemptive bids before the asset is auctioned. This is when things tag, and this is when prices soar. So origination will be key. And now actually some of the PE funds abroad are starting to kick in the use of artificial intelligence in the due diligence phase to have more confidence in the bidding phase. Should they stay and confidently bid in a valuation where not confident, they can actually sell above it in the future or walk away ahead. So origination and ability of due diligence using AI is key for the coming period.
Yeah, what do you think? Family businesses, are they expanding globally now?
I mean, I agree with His Royal Highness. In fact, when we bought the Carrefour shares out, I had to look where are the next frontiers. We negotiated to have rights in Africa because obviously as the Middle East becomes fairly quickly saturated, where is a natural market where the experience and expertise that we had developed locally could be applied? I mean, these are natural markets. There was no point for us to go and compete in Europe or the US or in some of the other markets in Asia. So yes, I mean, but these are the larger family businesses. But again, you know, I think how many also successful groups are looking at regional platforms? Because yes, Dubai is an important global retail center, but you have either rely on visitors, tourists, regional tourists, or you go to where the markets are. I mean, Egypt, obviously being a large country, large population, still underdeveloped in detail, is a very good opportunity. So that's a natural evolution. And I think that's where private capital can come in, because even many of the groups at some point would say, well, I want to go to Egypt, but I don't want to go alone. I want to be developing real estate. Then I need a local partner. So these are the kind of things where you find opportunity.
So just to kind of close off our discussion, unfortunately, the Abraj saga started here. I read the court's decision in Dubai, and surprisingly, the Abraj funds were not registered with the IFC. Somehow, they operated here.
They used the Cayman Island structure.
Exactly. Yes. They used the Cayman Island structure. So, in a way, legally, right, they should have been registered here. They were not registered here. And the regulators couldn't see what they did.
If you think about it, it's a Cayman Island fund, and Dubai is being blamed.
Exactly, yeah. So it's very unfair.
But that doesn't leave the DIFC off the hook.
Yeah, of course.
The reality is, a few people had concerns about Abraj, but it was too much of a success story to be criticized. Mm-hmm. It was maybe too connected, maybe too many people knew about it, but Cayman Island walked away, no issues, they're in DIFC. And a lot of people were very upset who are based in DIFC. They're saying, look, international parties are looking at DIFC-based capital negatively, but as my esteemed colleague said, DIFC is one of the best real estates in the world. For Dubai, it's a real estate bay providing a platform for financial advisory units and a place where everyone can congregate and do deals. it should have been caught. It should have been red flagged.
Including by the investors in those funds that were very sophisticated, right, supposedly.
No, because look, if you're given false documentation, Bernie Madoff did the same thing. You cannot, as an investor, there is an element of faith off that. I think, well, I know a little bit more, but I can't say too much
about
it.
Yeah.
But all I'm saying is that it left damage in Dubai, and we'll feel it for many years, but this is how laws in the West have been written.
Yeah.
You know, this is how you learn and you build up. And trust me, because I reach out to the central bank on a couple of issues. I reach out to ESCA on a couple of issues. I reach out to the stock exchange on a couple of issues. They are in the process of getting geared from this, but this has been a big wake-up call. And now I just say, I want to avoid a situation that could be like Abraj. And you get a response like this.
Mm-hmm.
You know, people know that Abraj is in the back of the head. They don't want to get caught by surprise again. I mean, it knocked the confidence of the world in this. And to a certain degree, remember, £1, I'll go back to that note. It's a promissory note for, I give you this piece of paper, you give me an ounce of gold. Without that fundamental trust, the global financial system can crack.
Absolutely agree. I mean, it was such an outlier event. And
I think, I mean, it's clearly at the end of the day, it's an unfortunate event that happened in Dubai, but the reality of the matter, as Royal Highness said, at the end of the day, Madoff also was actually a very, very big event in the US. I mean, the company, by the way, was regulated by the SEC, who didn't even have a Cayman fund. So I think, from my perspective, this was an outlier, but the problem, it was the biggest firm in the region. In fact, it was one of the biggest emerging markets firms, which has shaken confidence by investors in the emerging markets, actually asset class, private equity asset class in general. Mm-hmm. I think people will overcome it over time. I think today, I would say, the only thing the IFC could have done is to probably act a lot earlier.
I think, look, in our culture, when they don't have full information, they freeze and they do not respond. And from history, that's always been the safer bet. You wait, you be quiet.
Also, if you look back at history, the first or the biggest accounting fraud happened first was Ernen. It was outside of our region. Remember, inflating the assets and the balance sheet. Look back at the financial crisis, the LIBOR setting case against the biggest banks in the US and in the UK. It was not caught early on. Investigations took time, yet people will have to overcome this, and life goes on because it's an industry like anything. People choose to behave in different means. What is important is that corrective actions are taken and compliance measures are in place. So actually, I see that the issue of Abraj, the region will get over it, maybe some more compliance mm-hmm. requirements, and the countries are keen to put them in place themselves, but it should not be something we're ashamed of. It's okay. It happens.
It's a sign of a maturing market.
It happens, exactly.
It's a company issue, not a systemic issue.
Of course, yes. Of course. It is. It's quite an idiosyncratic event. Thank you very much. I'm mindful of the time. Thank you very much for your time, for your insights. It was a very pleasant, very insightful discussion. Thank you very much, Your Royal Highness. Thank you very much, Omnia. Thank you very much, Iyad. This was a very fascinating discussion.
This was a London Business School podcast, bringing you fresh insights and ideas from London Business School's experts. To listen and read more, visit www.london.edu.